dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle. And let's begin exploring the wine glass. Before I get into the podcast, I wanted to let you know that Apple had a podcast update. This caused an issue with the automatic downloads. If you are not receiving Exploring the Wine Glass podcast in your next up feed, it is because the settings have changed. Please go to Library, then Shows, and click Exploring the Wine Glass. If you don't see a check mark in the top right corner next to the three dots, the system does not download automatically. Please click on the down arrow and turn on automatic downloads. This will put a check mark next to the three dots and will allow you to always know when a new episode drops. Sorry for the inconvenience and thank you so much for following Exploring the Wine Glass. Today on the podcast, I am sharing my conversation with Gary Eberle of Eberle Winery in Paso Robles. Gary is truly an American legend. He is the recipient of the 2020 Wine Enthusiast Wine Star Award. He is almost single-handedly responsible for the pioneering of Syrah here in the United States and is known as the godfather of Paso Robles. If visiting Paso, Eberle is a must stop, and more than likely you will find Gary enjoying a glass of Viognier or Cabernet Sauvignon on the patio greeting customers. It was an honor to speak to Gary, and I know you are going to enjoy the conversation. Sláinte. Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Spanish wine scholar, Sommelier service, champagne and Côte d'Aron specialist, and a WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. Stay in the know about all things wine by visiting my website, exploringthewineglass.com. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Even in the Bible, give me the red, red wine. All right, so we are now sitting down with Gary Eberle. And this, first of all, an honor because, you know, this is Paso and Paso wouldn't be Paso without you. So thank you for all you did for Paso.
Well, you know, I get a lot of that. You know, it was a, like I said so many times, it was a chicken or an egg thing. if everybody was going to succeed, Paso had to succeed. So it was very self-serving promoting Paso Robles.
Right. You know, and I say that people ask me all the time, what do you think is special about Paso? And I say, well, besides all the other stuff, like the soils and the climate and all of that, mm-hmm. It's the people. It's really the people of Paso that make it special.
And I'll tell you, when I first came to Paso from Davis in May of 73, the people, you know, it was a much smaller community. It was a community that was struggling agriculturally because we had lost the almond industry and the grain farmers were lucky to break even. And they were really in need of an agricultural product that could keep kids here or bring them back from after where they went to school. And grapes just fit the bill.
When you came to Paso to look around, you really focused in on this east side. And what did you see about the east side that made you say, yes, this is the place I want to be?
Actually, when I first came down here, and I made three trips with two of my professors down here, an exploration of the Central Coast, primarily Paso. I like the West Side because the West Side is so pretty.
Yes.
It's romantic. You drive down Vineyard Drive, man, it just, and my professors essentially hit me on the back of the head and said, no, that's not where you want to grow your grapes. You want to be over here on the East Side. So I was directed really by my professors, Doc Olmo and Doc Alley, because the soil here, because we're in a bit of a rain shadow, so we don't get the amount of vegetation. So we don't have a lot of organic material in our soil. But we've got essentially 20 foot of subsoil, and that's what they liked so much. Pretty open, because, you know, over a couple millennia, the Europeans have learned that you plant your trees, your olive trees, your almond trees, your grapes, anything like that on the hillsides in the poorer soil, and you put your row crops and everything down on the good soil. So, yeah, I remember Doc Alley particularly. He was, he just said, oh man, this, he said, you know, the whole area is a bunch of sedimentary rock, a lot of calcareous slates and shales, a little bit of limestone, but it's minimal. But the vines don't care whether it's limestone or, you know, soapstone. I mean, it's the calcium that they want. And they want roots, soil that the roots can go down forever. And this soil here allows us to go down. I remember once we had a blowout of a main line when I was at Australia. The vines were only maybe 7 years old at that time. And 12, 13 foot down in this ditch that was dug out by the little Grand Canyon, by the way, faint line, there were grapevine roots down there.
Wow.
And these were relatively young vines. So this, the soil over here and the climate over here just was not for all grapes, but for the Bordelais grapes, the Rhone varietals, a lot of the northern or the Italian and Spanish grapes, the climate, and that's all of Paso Robles. It's just so suited for those, you know, the climate is really so suited. There's a lot less difference in climate in east and west side of Paso Robles than there is in soil types.
Okay.
But very similar. I mean, if you go outside and you look at the trees that we planted, we did not plant them on a 45 degree angle. You know, we had them staked, but the wind that comes through the Templeton Gap hits us about 2 minutes after it hits Highway 46 West and 101. And we get the same
pretty
intensity.
Powerful.
And the temperature drops that signifies or brings about.
So when you came and you started, you didn't start with Eberle Winery. You started with Estrella, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's about 3 miles.
Not too far.
Yeah, we bought about 1,400 acres, and we planted about 700. I designed the irrigation system and supervised the installation of it and the planting, also the design of the original building. I originally thought we were going to do about 48,000 cases, and by the time I left, we were doing close to 300,000. And it wasn't what I wanted.
Right.
And I wanted my own winery. I wanted to stay small. And we're still under 30,000 cases. And we concentrate on quality. You know, that's easy to say. Everybody says it. But it's really difficult to do it when you're starting to make hundreds of thousands of cases. I think Laura is probably the exception to the rule. They've maintained a level of quality for the size of the winery they are that I find rather amazing. But, good choice. They know what they're doing over there.
And so we were at the Esprit de Vin event, which is a celebration of the wineries on the 46 East. And so what do you think the purpose of that event is? Because as we were talking off mic, it's been like 20 years that they've been doing this. So it's obviously a successful event. What's the goal of it?
Well, you know, I mean, even initially, because it's so much prettier, more romantic on the west side, even though the grapes, for the most part, in Paso Robles are grown over here, people tended to go over there because, and they just assume because it's so pretty and picturesque that that's where the best wines are being produced. And the Esprit de Vin was set up so that, hey, we'll give you a reason to come over here, try our wines. You're going to find out that the wines produced on the east side are every bit as good, in some cases better than the wines that are being produced on the west side of town. And it has worked now. I mean, it used to be there was only like a dozen wineries over here. Now there's not nearly as many as there are on the west side, but there's a whole lot of wineries over here now. I would say got to be in excess of 50 on the west side of Paso, or 101.
And so when they all come together, do you think that there's, because they are all on the east side, do you think there's a common thread through the wines that you taste? Do you think that you could blind taste and say this is an east side wine?
No. I defy. I've said it up many times. I've been judging wine judges, commercial wine judging. I can't tell you the number of times, certainly since 1985. And I set up East and West Side wines blind with competent wine people. And they say, okay, which is East, which is West? Nobody can tell the difference. No, you know, what tells the difference is when you, the growers and the winemakers, the growers that produce the best grapes and the winemakers that don't wreck the grapes when they get a hold of them, that's what makes the difference. Man, that's a great wine. That's a great wine. This is East Side. That's West Side. Wow. Who was growing? Richard Sweat was growing this. Javi Steinbeck was growing that. I mean, I think as much as East West, because we buy grapes, and most of the fruit that we get is East Side fruit. Because I know, but we get, probably 10-15% of our fruit from the West Side. But we don't go because it's West Side. We go because we know the grower. And that's why on our wines, our bottles, if it's not estate grown, we identify the grower, because we want to make sure that they get every bit as much credit for the quality of the wine as what we do as the winery itself.
Now, do you think, now, I know we just answered that you can't blind taste East versus West, but, you know, wine regions are very, they want to have a thread throughout. So, you know, like Perlot, minerality, right, in Spain. What do you think is the Paso thread? Is there one?
I really don't think there is. I like I said, I defy anyone blind tasting.
More of a marketing thing, do you think?
Yes. I mean, you know, we now have, I think, 11 sub-appellations. Can you name 11 of them?
I can do Estrella.
Yeah.
Adelaide.
El Pomar, Gracia. Okay. But even more important, can you name 3 wineries in each of them? Right. You go to Napa, there's, I believe, 19 sub-appellations within Napa. Can you name it? It's the most famous appellation in the United States is Napa. You know, I mean, and could you name 3 wineries? Right. No, it is a marketing tool. Pay attention to the grower. Pay attention to the consistency of the wines coming out of a particular winery and the vineyards that's growing the grapes that they're making these wines up. That's the important thing in wine tasting. And the other thing, 2 other things to remember. I used to do a whole lot of lecturing, and I used to start off the lecture with there are 2 rules in wine drinking. One, most importantly, if you like it, it's a good wine. If you don't like it, it's not a good wine. Okay? And the other is, a wine's first responsibility is to be red. But I tell you, one of the great showmen in our industry, George Riedel, God love him, he's a lot like John Charles. he designed the Riedel glasses. And in fact, these are Riedel glasses. And there's a sensuousness about them. They're thin,
yes,
just well-made wine. But he goes a step further and he says, I make different shaped glasses to put the wine, that particular wine, on that certain spot in your mouth where it's going to be appreciated the most. Well, that's great, except that, my background was medical school and I was teaching histology and cytology labs. Everybody's taste buds are as different as their fingerprints.
Yes.
Literally. And you say, okay, so you're going to have, if George Riedel would have to design a glass for every single person for, come on, George.
But he sells a lot of glasses.
Oh, you betcha. And I'll tell you what, if you go to my house, you will find Burgundy glasses and claret glasses and champagne flutes and port glasses and Syrah glasses, all different ones, because there is
a difference.
Exactly, it's fun.
Yeah, I was at a wine event in New York, and they were doing Riedel was doing a glass fermentation thing, and I went in, and it was the same wine in different glasses. And whether it's your brain or not your brain, they tasted differently. I'm not going to say one glass was better than the other glass or this or that, but they definitely did taste different. Mm-hmm. But again, could be in your brain what you're being told.
Yeah, I mean, you know, different glasses are going to give you more or less of the aromas coming out of them. Yeah. But it's the same wine. And once you get it in your mouth, it's the same damn wine.
Yep.
Remember, most of wine tasting is nose.
Right.
It's not taste. You know, we only have four tastes. But, you know.
All retronasal.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's the first time you dip your nose into the glass, it really makes the difference. Right.
And I tell people all the time, similar to you, if you like it, don't let anybody tell you it's not a good wine. Yeah. And those people who love the $2 chuck, which I think now is like $4 or whatever, right? Kudos.
Yeah.
Because they're enjoying wine at $4 or whatever. Yeah. And if they like it, that's all that matters. Yeah. And then the other thing that I always talk about, and we can geek out a little bit on this, is how I never tell people what they're going to taste in a wine, because the way their brain works is different. Those neurons, those synapses, they've all grown through your experience. Mm-hmm. And what you're tasting as strawberry is really not the same thing that I'm tasting as strawberry.
And as you mature, your taste for wines mature. I mean, there was a time where I thought that the Twosome Lancers were, you know, Neil Diamond's Crackling Rosy, were just, you know, the cat's meow. And now, okay, yeah, it was Kool-Aid for the kids, you know. But once people get into wine, really, and explore it a little bit, really just for themselves, they find that your taste buds or your taste evolve pretty predictably for most people. Some people retrograde, actually. But most people, with time, go through a progression that is pretty predictable about the wines that they're going to like.
Right. I remember back to my first wine that I was like, oh, this is wine, you know? Mm. And there the difference between, well, I can drink wine, and then I tasted this Chardonnay, and I was like, wow, this is wine. And that's really the wine that got me into really diving into wine and learning about it. And I can't drink it now.
Yeah.
Because it's a complete, my palate profile has changed completely. Yeah.
I had an awesome moment like that also. I mean, I had been drinking, like I said, Matus, Lancers, Blue Nun, Boone Farm, Dos Oakies. And then the first time I really got a chance where I was presented with, and it wasn't like I was, they started me with fourth growths or second growths. I remember 1966 Chateau Latour, first growth, and it was like, and I didn't even, I mean, it didn't hit me that this was, you know, one of the premier wines of the world. It was, I didn't know that much about wine. I wasn't there to drink wine, I was there to listen to opera, but that's a different story. And it was like, wow. This is unique. This is, wow. And it hit me, and it is the epiphany that got me out of med school to do my doctorate at UC Davis. Yeah, I mean, the whole process took from the time I first had that wine until I was in a car driving to UC Davis was probably 12 weeks.
Oh. Wow.
I mean, because I dug right into it. And I'm down in New Orleans, and, you know, everything was French. And, you know, I had trouble affording the first growths. But, I mean, I drank a lot of Lynch Bage and Becheville and, you know, second and third growths. Mm-hmm. And
Not too bad.
Yeah. And every now and then, someone would get a bottle of Margaux or Lafitte, and I just said, I don't want to be, because I was a National Science Fellow, doing work in genetics, published papers, patents in genetics, going to be teaching in med school, I just said, you know what? I don't want to be a geneticist. I want to be an alcoholic. And I transferred to UC Davis and came out, and I said, May of 73 to Paso. While I was at Davis, I made several trips down here. And I'm here at the winery every day.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, this is the 45th year of Eberle Winery. And it's my 51st year in the industry, not counting two more years at Davis. I can't count those, but I've never gotten tired of the business. I love it. I'm having fun every day. And people say, when are you going to retire? 1993 or 1983. I'm done. This is my retirement program. I'm one of the lucky people that just found out what they were meant to do or what they love to do. It's almost more hobby than it is occupation.
Right.
I'm having a ball. I mean, especially when it's warm.
I sit
outside and we don't charge for tasting. We give complimentary tours about 8 or 9 a day down through the whole winery and explaining the whole winemaking process down through the caves. Because I think Mr. Mandavi used to say, hey, your job is not just to make wine and make people appreciate it, but you're also going to be an educator, because a lot of people, they're not wine writers or people immersed in the industry, and they need you need to bring them along. So why do you do this? This is why we do this, and that type of a thing. And like I said, and we don't charge for tasting, the same reason. I remember him telling me one day, he said, because I'd asked him if he was going to start charging, and he bristled, not get angry, but he said, don't ever charge. Americans are fair people. He said, your job is to make the wine so good that you don't have to bribe them to buy it. So to this day, we still don't charge.
Okay. That's a quote. That should be a quote. You have your quote on the, walk in, you should have that on the other side of it.
Yeah, that gets to the difference between wine and children. Yes. You sit down and reason with a bottle of Cabernet. A lot of people take pictures of that.
Yes, I'm sure they do. Yeah. I'm sure they do. And so we are going, let's talk about the caves.
Okay.
How long, because were you like one of the first people to have?
Certainly the first south of the bay.
Right, in our area.
We were the only ones. And for a long time, about 20 years, we were the only ones that had caves down here.
And what was that like building? Digging, or is it called building? Excavating?
It's boring out. The machine that does the digging is called a roadheader. It's a Welsh coal mining machine. And we're down, the caves are 35 foot underneath us. You get down past about 20 foot, 25 foot, temperature remains very constant at that point. That's, you want to get down there. And they could dig faster than they could get rid of the spoils, the dirt.
Oh, okay.
So the machine was probably capable of digging 50, even 60 foot of tunnel a day. But they were doing maybe 18
because they're the cleanup.
A day. Like they'd do a 6 foot section, pull the machine back, get rid of while they're getting rid of the dirt, they'd lay up 2 inches of shotcrete, then they'd dig another 6 foot and pull the machine back all the way, and they'd do a second 2 inches on the where we got the first two, and then 2 inches on the first. And every day at the end of every day, they did about 18 foot. And at the end of the day, there would be 2 or 3 inches of shotcrete, which is a weird, that's a weird stuff. But the whole thing is roughly 17,000 square foot, a lineal foot. There's one tunnel that's over 100 yards, another one that's just under 100 yards, and then there's two more shorter tunnels, and then one, two, three cross tunnels.
Wow.
So then there's a first time down there without a guide, you can get lost. I'm serious. You'd be surprised. But my goal is, if I live long enough, I want to dig another 8,000 square foot tunnel and put an elevator in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's time.
Yeah. And now, a word from our sponsor. Looking to be in the know about Dracena Wines? Want to be the first to know about our new releases and special offers? All you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You'll immediately get a discount code for 10% off your first purchase and be privy to newsletter-only discounts. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Visit our website, www.dracenawines.com, or use the link in show notes to sign up. It will take you less than a minute, but the rewards will last a lifetime.
The big thing, we're here at Eberle, and people say all the time, if it's in the morning, you're here drinking Viognier, and we are. We have a nice glass of... Oh, okay.
The Viognier is what I use to wash down the Advil in the morning for my knees. And then afternoon, it's time to go to real wine. That's when I go to the... I would say 10-12% of my consumption is Viognier. About 80% is Cabernet. That's the wine that I came to California to make. And then I have about 7 or 8% of the different things. Because, I mean, I really, you know, I pioneered Syrah in the United States. I planted and made my first Barbera in 78. I love Barbera. But as good as it is, and especially with foods that have a lot of oil or fats in them, Barbera is a great palate cleanser because of the high natural acidity. But, you know, I'll bet I don't drink 5 glasses of Chardonnay a year. I've got my personal preferences, and that's what I tell people. You can drink what you like, and I try to live up to that.
And about how many SKUs do you make now?
Oh, boy. That's not quite fair, because we do things that we do once. Do things like our port. We make our port every 3 years because it's made all from legitimate Portuguese varieties, Tinto Madeira, Sousa, Albistardo. But we age them in these cognac puncheons that we bought, used cognac puncheons. And the wine stays in there about 2.5 years. So we only have the port every 3 years. But there are, you know, Cabernet, Chardonnay, Viognier, Barbera, Syrah, our Faubourg Red, our Rhone.
Côte de Robles.
Okay. Yeah, we do those every year. But I don't think there's any wine that we really have a 12-month supply of. If you come, you know, in February and you look at what's available to drink, and you come in August, there will be some of the same wines, but there will be different wines because when... You know, geez, we ran out of rosé. Okay, we're going to release the Côte de Robles Blanc. Or we run out of Zinfandel and we're releasing the new Syrah, that type of thing. We try to keep at least 6 or 8 wines. And the flagship is, you know, is our Eberle Estate Cabernet. That's the one wine that we always have. The vintage changes. But I think I can honestly say we've never not had Cabernet in the tasting room. It's just, you know, that's our flagship. You know, we're without Viognier for a while. We're without Chardonnay, Barbera, Sangiovese. There are different things that we're out of. But we try not to ever be out of Cabernet. Because I might dry up and blow away.
That is, Cabernet actually is, right, the number one plant and grape variety here in Paso by quite some.
Yeah, it's I would say pretty close to 50% of the grapes grown in the Paso Robles Appellation is Cabernet.
What are you growing right here on the estate here?
Estate Cabernet, that's the biggest part of it. And we've got 2 acres of pick pool, about 2 acres of Muscat Canelli.
Oh, wow.
9 acres of Viognier and about 7 acres of Chardonnay.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I didn't know you did pick pool. How did I not know
that? It's brand. This.
Oh, okay.
Chris wanted to work. You know, because I'm not the winemaker anymore. You know, I'm going to be 80 next month. I can't be a winemaker. I can barely lift the wine
glass.
But
I was going to say, you can lift the Viognier glass.
Well, as long as it's not full. It has to be half full. And he wanted to work with it. I don't think he wants it as a varietal standalone. I think he wants it as a blender in our Côte de Rebels Blanc.
Oh, okay.
That's right now it's Roussillon, Viognier, and Grenache Blanc. And he wants to put some pickle in there.
Give it a little zing.
Yeah. And the reason that we put it in is pickle right now is getting a lot of attention, and there's not much of it planted.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to come up with a grower that you really wanted to work with that had some. So we thought, okay, we'll do our own. And it looks very promising.
And so when was that planted?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay. Yeah. So this 2024 will be a third vine.
Right.
Okay.
We'll get some fruit off of it this coming year.
That's exciting. I love pickpull. It's exciting.
I mean, when it comes to white wine, I still think
Viognier.
Because, you know, you get that stone fruit, peach, apricot, a little honeysuckle, dry, and yet, you know, when you first take it into the mouth, because it's a heavy, it's a white wine that thinks it's red. And you get the sensation that, man, there's just a little sugar there. And it's not. No. It's completely dry, but it's got so much fruit on the nose that it kind of fools you into saying, got to be some sugar in there.
It is, I think, one of the, if not the most aromatic white grape variety.
Yeah, well, you have to take Rieslings and Gewurz and the Muscats.
Oh, yeah. But Muscats are very...
Yeah, wines with a little of the terpenes in them.
Yes.
But you have to be a genius winemaker to make a dry Muscat. Kenny Volk at Wild Horse made a dry Malvasia. That was very, very, and because the terpenes tend to be bitter. And that's why Muscats tend to have a little sweetness to them to override that bitterness. You say, if you get a wine like a good Gewurztraminer, and it's got some terpenes, but it's not full-on terpene.
Right.
But even the Gewurz, and they're very lovely. I mean, at the end, you're going to get a little shot of bitterness on the back of your tongue.
Right. I think that's also a bit the food pairings with that make a huge difference, as with all wines, but with Gewurz and Rieslings in particular, I think. Yeah. When you're here and you're drinking your Viognier in the morning and you switch to the cab in the afternoon, you know, when you come in, I remember the first time we visited before we had our winery, before everything, you were sitting outside. And
that's my preferred spot.
That is,
but I have not had a pair of long pants on. Got to be 3 years. I mean, I don't. I wear shorts. Even my tuxedo.
Are shorts?
They're shorts. Patent leather shoes, knee high or black socks.
Shorts. Love it.
And then tux with my studs and the whole thing. But and when it's cold and I've got football knees, I've got metal knee. And when it gets cold, it aches. So when it's cold, I can sit outside for a little bit, but I usually wind up sitting inside in front of the fireplace. But I prefer to be outside. I love sitting at the front entrance and greeting people, trying to make people laugh, something just make people laugh. That, you know, give them a good reason besides just the wine to remember you. Also, don't ever change your label. You say, even if you've got an ugly label, which I think our label, in retrospect, is kind of ugly. I mean, I paid a Cal Poly graduate in graphic arts $75 to I mean, everything I did was on a shoestring.
Right.
And if you go on the fireplace and the mantle, you can see my very first label, which is 79 Cabernet, and the appellation is San Luis Obispo, because we did it. And then in 82, Tom Martin, Vic Roberts, myself, Herman Schwartz, we said, okay, we need a Paso Robles appellation. And we filed and got it. And I waited to print the appellation or my label for the 1980 cab until we had the BATF came through. And at the time, it was a pretty easy thing, and it didn't cost much. Now it costs hundreds of dollars.
I was going to say, now it's like a booklet.
It was, I mean, I did the meteorology and the geology for the, because of my science background, and I dabbled in both of them. And, but my 80 Cabernet was the first wine to ever have a Paso Robles appellation on it.
That is awesome.
And there's a bottle of it up on the mantle. And that's the wine, it was in UC Davis 75th anniversary collection. And it's the wine President Reagan took to China. And we always knew when President Reagan was coming to the Western White House, because we'd get an order for a couple of cases. And in Simi Valley at the Reagan Museum, there's a full bottle of my 80 cab. And in the ranch house, in the kitchen, up on a shelf, is an empty bottle of my 80.
Oh my gosh.
But he served it to Gorbachev and to Margaret Thatcher independently.
How did he come? How did the connection occur?
When he was governor, got a lot of wine from David up in Sacramento. And when it won, it was one of the 12 wines, 6 Cabernet and 6 Chardonnay in the UC Davis anniversary collection. He got some. He liked it. He introduced President Reagan to it. And that's where it started.
Wow. Yeah. That's impressive. Like, I always, you see that served at the White House or served whatever.
Yeah.
That must be an incredible honor. Like, wow.
I'm not sure Reagan would take good wine to the communists, but that always worried me.
Well, I think your labels are very distinctive.
Go out and look on the mantle, you'll see from the very first, there's actually 3 different labels, but the changes were very little. And one started off Everly Winery.
Oh, okay.
And instead of this boar, which I got out of one of the dictionaries, a picture of a boar, I used a stylized one. The gal did a stylized boar's head. And it looked like the Cub Scout Weebelo.
Oh.
And too many people said, how did you get the Cub Scouts to let you put a Weebelo or their emblem? And I didn't think about it.
I saw a boar. Yeah. I saw a boar.
So we went to the other label, and it still had Everly Winery, but it had this boar, but on a just solid gold. And then somebody said, hey, Everly is what you want on there, not Everly Winery. We know it's a winery. And make the boar more prominent. And that's what we did. And this is the label we've had for at least the last 20 years.
Well, and you have the boar outside.
Yep, 2 of them. I mean, there's the big one.
Right.
This.
Oh, yeah. Here.
And then the we boar. Have the a copy of the one in Florence.
Great.
We
took a picture when we were in Florence, and then we were like, hey.
Rub the nose.
Yeah. It's all like rubbed off.
Yeah, and there's a couple of holes in it. It's been rubbed.
Yeah. It's the same thing in Scotland. There's a statue of a dog, and the dog, the story is there's a graveyard, and his master had passed away, and he stayed by the gravesite forever. And there's the statue of the dog, and it's the same thing. You rub his nose for good luck, and it's mostly gone.
Yeah. Well, ours is, I mean, the one in Florence has been there, you know, what, about 5 centuries. So it'll take a while for this one to get that.
But people do it, huh?
Yeah. Oh, they do, absolutely. And mm-hmm. they put coins in the fountain there, and they're all, we donate them to different children's charity functions or mm-hmm. soccer teams or whatever. I mean, we collect about $600 or $700 in coins a year.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's a lot of wishes.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I was sober.
Or it could be thankful because you open up early. You were mm-hmm. the, you know, so they could be thankful for being open this early. Yeah. Now, when you're sitting outside, do you think the majority of people know who you are? Or are you just some guy drinking wine on the porch?
I would say a third or a half. A lot of people, you know, they'll go to other wineries and they'll say, you know, where are you going? Going to Everly. Oh, you'll probably see Mr. Everly sitting out front.
Yep.
Say hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of people that come by and they've been here maybe 3 times. But I see, you know, I mean, there are days where we have over 500 people.
Wow.
You know, just in a day. And I'm meeting people all the time. And they say, geez, we were here 3 years ago. You remember?
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I can't remember what I had for breakfast.
But I remember the first time we came, as I said before, we had the winery and everything. We pulled up and you were sitting outside. And I will never forget this. I said, that's Gary sitting outside. And my husband's like, because I had an uncle named Gary. And he's like, what's he doing here? And I'm like, no, not him.
Yeah. Different Gary.
Yeah, different Gary. Different Gary. But anyways, I want to thank you for taking the time to, yes, I will never say no to your Viognier. I told you that. For taking time to talk to me and to share your enthusiasm for Paso. I like to think of myself as a Paso proponent and one day maybe be able to be more outspoken for Paso. But that's what part of this podcast is about. There's a lot of Paso people that I've interviewed on this podcast to try to just promote this region as, you know, we fell in love with it years and years and years ago and knew this was where we were going to end up. And it's kind of our dream that we're here.
Yeah. Paso has so much to offer. And I think, you know, people say, you know, Paso ever going to be Napa Valley. No, I don't think we want to be Napa. I think we're more Sonoma than Napa. And I hope it stays that way. I see some movement towards people trying to move in that direction. And I don't think that's the strong suit for Paso. I mean, right now we've got great wineries, great winemakers, spectacular vineyards. And now restaurants that are outstanding. You get hotel rooms, and you can go anywhere from, you know, Motel 6 or 8, whatever, to the Bella Sera, to Allegretto, Cheval. I mean, you've got and everything in between. I mean, you can have as fine a stay in Paso Robles as you can in Napa. Or anywhere. I mean, it's easier to get around. It really is.
Yeah.
Except when it really rains hard and the wind blows on the west side because they got so many trees that come down.
It is a little difficult. Last weekend, people were talking and they were like, "Oh, we're gonna go out to out to the west side tomorrow." I was like, I think you might want to go today. Yeah. Go today because tomorrow
is going to be... it can be a little iffy.
Yeah.
And it's not the rain that does it. It's the wind.
Right.
And you got, you know, all of that vegetation, the trees are hanging over the roads and boom, all of a sudden...
All that beauty becomes...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you cannot deny the west side of town... the hills, the forested areas there and everything are just, it's just pretty.
Well, I don't know. I've been here at Everly at sunset.
Yeah, we look into the sunset. You see the sun setting over the mountains. It is pretty
magnificent.
Yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny because I never thought anything about the view and everything. You know, the soil and the access to 46 when I bought this piece. And I paid $3,200 an acre. And now it's probably worth like $75,000 an acre. And I struggled. I had 17 partners. I started with, and I own 35.5%. Now I have two other partners, and I own about 83%. And I just keep been buying them out. Now the other two, the Howie Steinbeck and Dick Woodland, they're going, we don't want to sell. We like it. Come on, man. Before I die, I want to own it all. But I know they're great guys. I really appreciate both of them. You know, if you're going to have partners, I mean, Dick Woodland is, man, and Howie Steinbeck, they're two of the most wonderful people I've ever known in my life. You know, they're the kind of person that you wish, geez, I wish he'd been my father. You know, that kind of,
right.
I mean, they're just, not a lot of gray with them. There's a lot of black and white,
right.
You know, and it's, I love them both. And I've known them both so long. I've known, probably met him first time before I even came to Paso, but because he was working at the agricultural supply.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure I ran in and talked to him there. If not, it was right after I came to Paso. Because we were doing a lot of business with him. And Dick, I'm sure I met within 5 years of the time I came to Paso.
So 45 years here on this estate. And did you purchase the whole estate at the same time with their home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 65 acres.
How does that like happen? Like you were at Australia at that time?
Yeah.
And then this came up and you're like, hey.
It came up. It had been part of the Hugh Black properties, and the Mundys bought it. And they still have Harvey Mundy, and the sons and grandson still have the property just the other side. And it came for sale, and I had driven it past it at least twice a day for 10 years. And this was a piece that we had done the soil types.
I was on
here with both Doc Alley and Doc Omo. And I just, you know, the whole thing that was plantable was one contiguous soil type, which is very advantageous. You know,
rare.
When you're planting and you're going to irrigate, because you don't have to screw your irrigation like I did at Australia with that 700 acres. We had like six different soil types. Couple major, most of them minor, but I mean, they all create their own little problems. And it came, and it came available, and I met Mr. Mundy, and we talked. And he wanted more than I could afford. And I said, well, hey, let me come in as a partner, and maybe instead of the 3,600 an acre, we can get it down to 3,200 an acre. And that, it really sort of went that way. And it worked out. And he really didn't want to be part of the winery. Mm-hmm. He was, he just wanted the sale. Because within a year and a half, he came and said, hey, I want to sell my share. And I, fine, okay.
Like, okay.
That's, yeah.
Wow. I think about that, and you know, like, if you're talking about you paid $3,200, now it's like $75,000 or whatever. I wish that I could have gone back in time, but it's always what you want is usually just out of your reach,
yeah.
Right? And then, you know, maybe 5 years later, you can afford more, but then what you want is still just out of your reach. Yeah. So you've gotta find a way to get that. And so.
Well, I mean, I knew that I wanted my own winery from about 1979, because I saw where Australia was going, and it wasn't where I wanted to go. And I, you know, like I said, everything I've done on a shoestring until recently now, I'm not missing any meals, you can tell. And we've got things really going good. Not my biggest problem, but, I've been approached so many times, people saying, hey, you're 77 years old, we'd like to buy your winery.
Right.
And I said, no, it's not for sale. And I've had people offer me more than I know it's worth. It's not for sale. I said, I will die owning this winery. Well, what happens then? I've got no family. I've got two French poodles. But I've set up a trust so that when I pass, my key employees get the winery.
That's very nice.
Because they've made my life so easy. And they let me do, pretty much what I want. Sit out front or sit in front of the fireplace. And, I've had people say, man, you could do your millions, right. You could do anything.
But if you're happy, right, money isn't, that saying, money isn't everything.
Yeah.
Being happy is worth more.
If I sell it to you, I can't do what I want because I'm doing what I want.
Right.
Please go away, you're hurting my feelings.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is, it's a dream. It's not an easy business to be in.
No.
And it's a lot of...
I think only restaurants are more volatile than wineries. And one of the things I don't understand is when you get a winery and it's happening constantly and you're making pretty damn good wine and access to some good fruit and people are in the business, like 7-8 years and they sell. And I say, no, you've got to stay in the business for at least 10 to 12 years before you get enough consumers to recognize your label and really get going. Once you make it, boy, it's a great business, but you've got to stick with it.
It's a grind.
I hate to see people selling out when they have not succeeded. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with somebody that's been in business 30 years and they've done, and they're ready to retire. They've got kids and and even then I say, man, you should do that. Make some good wine.
Yeah.
It's a good life.
Yeah, I agree. It's a wonderful life. And what I really think is special, like I said at the beginning, is just, I think Paso, for as large as it is, because it actually is a rather large AVA, it's small.
Yeah.
Like, I see that circle of winemakers, and what I love is, and including Chris, when we made for the first time a white Cabernet Franc this year, and I was panicking because it wasn't white. And thankfully it ended up white, but I was able to text and call other winemakers here in Paso and ask, what can I do?
Yes.
Should I do this? What do you think about this? Whatever. And I don't think that's true in a lot of other wine regions. And that's...
Back in the 70s and 80s, there was such a small group. I mean, I think I knew everybody in the county that could spell grape. and we all, worked together. And I mean, hey, I need, my press broke. You got a press I can use for a day, or I need a mus pump. Can I borrow your mus pump for, 6 hours? Sure, no problem. We did a lot of that. But, the size of the Appalachian, people say, why did you do? Why? Because I drew up the boundaries of the Appalachian, me and Tom Martin. And it was because we wanted to make sure that anybody that had claim to Paso Robles was included. And the original boundaries, we had to extend them once to include Justin, because we didn't go that far west. And then we had to include Santa Margarita, because that wasn't part of the original. And York Mountain, remember Max Goldman did not want to be part of Paso Robles. And he was a bit of a man. I like Max. In the industry a long time. And Steve was a good guy. But Max just wanted his, he did not want to be part of passing. Mm-hmm. He was not putting up roadblocks. He said, Max, hey, let's make a York Mountain appellation, and we'll pay for it. We'll file it at the same time. You have your own. And that's why York Mountain technically is not part of Paso Robles. It's its own appellation. And that was to get Max out of our hair.
Here you go. Here's your appellation.
Yeah, you got it, man. No problem.
Oh, the stories. Yeah. I'm sure you have so many of them from
They're all scary.
Well, I'm going to raise my glass of this amazing Viognier. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me
share. And anytime, if you get a warm day, I'll be out front. We can do it out there.
All right. I will be more than happy to sit out there with you and watch the people come by as you talk to them, because I do. This is, I know you said at the beginning, you hear that a lot, but like when people ask me where they should visit, you are always my number one spot. And that is because I drink your wine, but, but two, Paso wouldn't be Paso without you. And I think that's quite, I don't know if you get tired of hearing that or whatever, but it is the absolute truth. And I don't think anybody can come to Paso and not experience your wine and your winery, because I don't think Paso would be what Paso is if it wasn't for you.
I don't even remember where it started, but somebody's started calling me the Godfather. And at first I was very embarrassed by that. I thought, oh man, come on, this is mine. That's... And because I look back and I look at, Tom Martin and Herman Schwartz and guys that really busted their hump. And then, but we all did. Vic Roberts and then Toby. And then we really did it together. But I guess I just outlived everyone, and I got a big mouth. I'm not shy. One of the things I used to say about Mr. Mandavi was that, he, in the nicest sense, was the P.T. Barnum of our industry. He drug California wine into the 21st century almost single-handedly. And I remember him sitting down and he said, man, you got to be out there. You got to be a showman. You can't just be a winemaker. You've got to be out there and carrying the flag and shouting it out.
I
learned it pretty well.
Well, I think it is the absolute truth. Mm-hmm. I think that would Paso be here? Probably, but would it be the Paso that we love and adore so much? I don't think so. I think it's a different.
I remember, when I first started, and this was prior to Everly, Estrella, and I'd be on the road and you'd be in New York or Miami or St. Louis, and you'd say, this is the wine we make in Paso Robles, and they go,
where?
Is that in Texas or Baja, California? No one knew Paso Robles. And it took 2 decades of great wines, and I mean really great wines, and Paso Robles, till we finally got enough winemakers making good wine, not just family winemakers or home winemakers, but trained people. One of the guys, I swear, that gets more or gets less attention than he deserved, really, is Vic Roberts. Vic Roberts, I remember back when he was at Creston Manor, some of the Cabernets that he produced out there, wow, they were great. They were great, but Vic has one big fault. He's an introvert.
Oh, okay.
He's just not, you can see he's just not really comfortable being out there, because he's made spectacular wines. He just needs to, he needs to be a little bit more of a cheerleader.
say I'm a Sagittarius, and I am a true Sagittarius. I am the spotlight person. I love being in the spotlight. I love talking sports-wise, point guard, center field, you know, where all the spotlights go.
Well, I think, and Tommy Myers is my first assistant winemaker. I hired him in 78, and then he over at Castoro. Spectacular winemaker. Very retiring. Terry Hogue, he's making some good wines. And he had a whole lot of credentials, I mean, other than just wine. But he was... Man, he was almost hermit, like a hermit. I mean, like, man, come on, get out there, raise that flag. Lead the charge, baby. You know, it'll do us good, and it'll do you even better.
Right, right. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to clink with you again and enjoy this Viognier. Give me the sweet,
sweet wine. This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com and sign up for my newsletter at exploringthewineglass.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Podcast music is Wine by Kevins. Until next week, Sláinte!